If you've had a chance to look through or read the latest Discern magazine, which is the January-February issue, you found an article in there by Mr. Joel Meeker entitled The World in 2019. Quite a fascinating article in which he analyzed different areas of the world, Asia, Africa, South and Central America, U.S. Being a house divided, the European Union, and the question of why the crisis of trust in so many parts of the world related to leaders and the populace of the country. Quite an interesting article. On the heels of reading this article, I came across an article that caught my eye because of the title that said, Alarming Facts About America in 2018. I want to read a few quotes from the article by way of introducing the sermon. And it begins by asking the question, was 2018 everything you expected it to be? Of course, each of us would have to answer that question for ourselves as far as what kind of year 2018 was for us. Some would say yes, and others would say absolutely not, and perhaps everything in between. The author goes on to say, this is from by Michael Snyder, Economic Collapse blog, January 1st, 2019. He says, every year contains surprises, but 2018 truly turned out to be a year that we will never forget. Over the past 12 months, we witnessed great political shaking, still going on. Wall Street experienced the worst downturn that we have seen since 2008. The crust of our planet was rattled by an increasing number of major seismic events. Social decay spread like wildfire, and America continued to become even more divided as a nation. In comparison, 2017 was rather bland and boring, he says. And I truly believe that one day we will look back on 2018 as a major turning point. Interesting statement. 2018 is a major turning point in the history of our country, the direction of our country, what's going on. Then he says the following are some amazing numbers from 2018 that are almost too crazy to believe. A list of facts and statistics I thought I'd again share with you. One study found that the average American spends 86 hours a month on a cell phone. So that's more than 22 hours a week on a cell phone. The middle class in America continues to decline, and at this point, half of all American workers make less than $30,500 a year. Since 2007, The total amount of student loan debt in America has nearly tripled. Student loan debt has become a crushing burden for many graduates. The suicide rate in the U.S. has risen by 33%, a third since 1999, and is now the second leading cause of death for Americans from age 15 to 24, suicide. According to the United Nations Population Fund, 40% of all births in the U.S. now happen outside of marriage, almost one half. But if you go back to 1970, that figure was sitting at just 10%. So in about 40 years, just under 50 years, it's gone from under 10% to 40%. Social decay is clearly evident, even in our most prosperous cities. One recent investigation found 300 piles of human feces on the streets of downtown San Francisco. Prosperous city, but you know, what a mess. Over half the country now receives more in government transfer payments than they pay in taxes. That is a definite tipping point where more people are receiving government assistance than are paying taxes. And that has crushed nations, empires in the past when the tax burden fell on the productive workers and reached that halfway tipping point. According to one recent study, the rate of people 65 and older filing for bankruptcy is three times what it was in 1991. People in their retirement years more than ever filing bankruptcy. If you go back to 1986, just 10% of all young adults were religiously unaffiliated, but now that number has jumped all the way to 39% who say they have no religious affiliation, young people. One study found that one-third of all American teenagers haven't read a single book in the past year. I've read one book in the past year. The number of married couples with children in the U.S. had just reached a 56-year low as far as replacing the replacement rate of replacing our population It's, you know, getting, we're going backwards. In the city of Baltimore, approximately one out of every four babies is born as an opioid addict. 25% of all babies in Baltimore are born as an opioid addict. According to the New York Times, this one amazed me, one-third of our American population. According to the New York Times, approximately 110 million Americans have a sexually transmitted disease right now. That is just an amazing fact. In October, we witnessed the third largest single-day point crash in stock market history on the exact same day that the third most powerful hurricane in the U.S. history made landfall. Has God removed a hand of protection on Israel? Certainly seems that is happening. In November, the CAP fire destroyed 14,000 homes and businesses in Northern California, the most destructive wildfire in the history of the state. And I believe it was 80 people or so that died in that fire. In the aftermath of the magnitude 7.0 earthquake that rattled Anchorage, the state of Alaska was shaken by more than 1,400 earthquakes, aftershocks. In early December, the largest earthquake in 45 years hit eastern Tennessee. In 2017, the Dow was either up or down by 1% or more just eight times in 2017. 2018, that happened 64 times. Talk about volatility on the stock market, uncertainty, growing uncertainty. And finally, during 2018, the U.S. national debt increased by nearly $1.4 trillion. We're now almost $22 trillion in debt, and there is no end to our debt problems on the horizon. Again, amazing numbers, all related to events happening, for the most part, or the status of things in 2018. Alarming facts about America in 2018. What does all of that mean for the future? For the future of our country, for the future of the world, what does the future hold? More specifically, where are we now in prophecy? Where are we now in Bible prophecy? Consider what's happening in Europe. We just took a look at the United States, but in Europe specifically, just one isolated case with Brexit, the United Kingdom exiting from the European Union. Isaac Khalil and Eric Jones wrote a fascinating article just recently, Could Brexit End the United Kingdom? I'd like to read a few quotes from the article. If you haven't read it on Life, Hope, or Truth or in your updated news blogs, it's worth reading, Could Brexit End the United Kingdom? Quoting from the article, the United Kingdom is currently engulfed in a quagmire of opinions on how to exit the EU. And this is having ripple effects throughout the EU as far as, you know, how is the EU handling this? And basically, not very sympathetic. Basically, get your act together, United Kingdom, because we're going on and we're not going to compromise and make it easy for you to execute this divorce, is the approach European Union has taken. The United Kingdom is currently engulfed in a quagmire of opinions on how to exit the EU. There seems to be no straightforward solution, and the breakup of the United Kingdom is an eventual possibility. Breaking up the United Kingdom, so there no longer is a United Kingdom. What's behind all of this? On June 23rd, 2016, the citizens of the UK voted to leave the European Union, what has become known as Brexit. Those who supported leaving said it would reinstitute Parliament's rights to make its own laws, retain the billions of pounds being given to Brussels, and regain control of immigration policy. Now, over 2.5 years later, the United Kingdom continues to be in a quagmire about how to fulfill that vote and exit the EU. Prime Minister Theresa May and her staff have spent the last 2 years negotiating a deal with the EU, and she presented her plan to Parliament recently. It has not gone over well, if you followed any of that. Some of the details of the plan include Britain's financial settlement. They would pay a divorce bill to leave. It is estimated to be around £39 billion, about $50 billion. But some have estimated the total bill for the next decade will cost Britain about £100 billion, or $130 billion. Securing rights of citizens. The plan secures the status of EU citizens in the United Kingdom and United Kingdom citizens in the European Union throughout the transition phase, which is to last till 2020. Also issues concerning the Irish border. I want to read these concluding comments in the article. Today, Great Britain has lost its empire and has much less influence, prestige, and wealth. In fact, it is struggling just to keep the union of England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland together. Brexit has caused deep tension in the union, with the majority of people living in Scotland and Northern Ireland voting to remain in the European Union. How did a people go from controlling the seas and ruling a quarter of the globe to struggling just to keep its core union from fracturing into pieces and possibly entering into a deal with the EU that some refer to as a form of captivity? God allowed the influence of the British Empire to dissolve into a loosely connected commonwealth. Soon he may allow the United Kingdom itself to come apart. But in terms of prophetic events, this will be the least of the problems coming upon the British people, because their sins, both of the sons of Joseph, the British and Americans will fall. Because of their sins, both of the sons of Joseph will fall, both the United States and Great Britain, we know. And again, the facts, the stats that I just read about America, and now what's going on in the United Kingdom, we see prophecy just coming to pass right in front of us as we're watching these events unfold. No matter how the present Brexit situation ends, Britain will continue its decline unless the British and the people of the Commonwealth wake up and return to God and his laws of morality. To learn more about the laws, and then it promotes our booklet, God's Ten Commandments, still relevant today. But we see that in Great Britain itself, the United Kingdom, there is this quagmire of you know, as far as what's going on with exiting the European Union. There was another article, I'll just read the title, Theresa May's Brexit Desperation Tour, traveling around Europe trying to gain support for her plan. Another article titled, Civil War, pro-EU veteran Ken Clark blasts hardcore Remainers, those who want to remain in the Union as opposed to those who want to exit it, who are plunging Britain into a crisis with their bid to cancel Brexit. Will the United Kingdom exit the European Union? Will the United Kingdom stay? What's going to happen? Will the United Kingdom come apart? For over 70 years, the Church of God has expressed the opinion that in the end time, Britain would not be a part of the United Kingdom. We have expressed that opinion. If you have been following the Deuteronomy classes with Dr. Levy, fascinating classes, when he covered Deuteronomy 27, he mentioned some speculation about which six tribes of Israel would be incorporated into the beast power and which six tribes of Israel would not be incorporated into the beast power. It was speculation he heard from a minister a number of years ago, but it made sense, and he pointed out to several scriptures in Deuteronomy 27 that seemed to indicate that. So there's a lot going on as we watch what's going on in the world scene around us that relates directly to prophecy. So again, I'll ask the question, and this is really what the bulk of the sermon is about. Where are we now in prophecy? Where are we now in prophecy? What should we be looking for next to happen as the end of the age marches on? What should we be looking for as we are warned and exhorted to watch faithfully, and to be aware of what's going on around us? What should we be looking for? What are the signs that we really are in the end of the age? I want to use the book of Daniel primarily to help us answer these questions, because Daniel really does provide some excellent guidelines about what to be looking for at the end of the age. And I think we can understand it in terms of modern day events and what's going on around us right now. So let's go to Daniel chapter 12. We'll come back to Daniel continually, so you might want to put a marker in the book of Daniel. And we'll look at Daniel chapter 12, and let's read verses 1, 2, and 3. Daniel 12, 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble. It's called a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, a unique time of trouble, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So here is described first a time of trouble, and also a time of resurrection of the saints at the return of Jesus Christ. Hold your place in Daniel, but turn back to Jeremiah 30. Jeremiah chapter 30, where Jeremiah also describes this same time of trouble. In Jeremiah 30, in verses 6 and 7, Jeremiah 30, verses 6 and 7. And Jeremiah describes this time in a unique way with an unusual metaphor. He says, "Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with child. So why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor? And all faces turn pale. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. And it is the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it." So Jeremiah describes a time of trouble, the same as what we just read in Daniel chapter 12. It's directed toward the modern-day descendants of ancient Israel, especially the United States and Great Britain, and it's talking about punishment on those nations because of sin. And again, some of the things we see going on in the world around us, in our nation around us, should clearly qualify as sin, as violating God's commandments. But go back to Daniel with me. Daniel 12, and let's read verse 4. Here, Daniel characterizes the time of the end in a certain way, in one way, the first of a list of things. He says, "But you, Daniel," 12, verse 4, "shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase." Two interesting statements about the time of the end, characterized as many shall run to and fro, and knowledge being increased, a sign or signs that the end of the age is arrived, has arrived, or is near. The Hebrew word for run, as in run to and fro, literally means to push forth. When it's used in Scripture, it has a figurative meaning of to lash at the ocean or to lash at the sea with oars, meaning to travel, to actually move. And our society has moved from riding horses for thousands of years to riding in automobiles, airplanes, rocket ships in the past 100 years or so, and travel with improvement in infrastructure. Travel is certainly implied in this verse and has gotten easier. You know, to get in our car in Wisconsin and 4.5 hours be here in Michigan, you know, I read a book recently about the Lewis and Clark Expedition, Undaunted Courage, and what it took for them to get from St. Louis to the mouth of the Columbia River. It was incredible hardship and several years of travel. Today we can be there in 4 hours, you know, from flying from Milwaukee to Seattle, and it's amazing what we are able to accomplish today. So this scripture certainly implies that when it says running to and fro includes that kind of travel. But there's more to it. The NIV translates this verse, many will go back and forth instead of to and fro. Many will go back and forth. And it says it's not limited to going from place to place, but the words in Hebrew also indicate something that is happening entirely within one's mind, going back and forth in one's mind. And the Hebrew implies being in the midst of a puzzle, being puzzled, a mystery, an enigma, something you can't figure out, going back and forth in your mind, or just being stressed out. And that in addition to the ability to travel anywhere in the world easily, the stress and the enigma of the mind and figuring things out will become greater and greater as the end of the age approaches. Minds flashing back and forth is what it's saying, because of all that is burdening them, because of the stress of the age and the stress of the time and what is on their mind. So this is one of the characteristics of the end of the age that Daniel mentions. Many shall run to and fro. That would be happening. And he says knowledge shall increase. And the Hebrew word for increase implies not just adding more, but actually multiplying or increasing exponentially. So knowledge, general knowledge, would be increasing exponentially. Did you know that currently knowledge of the human race, that the human race has, is doubling about every 13 months? Knowledge is doubling about every 13 months. And yet when it comes to the knowledge of God, that's decreasing and decreasing. Paul told Timothy that in the last days, remember what he said in 2 Timothy 3? Men would be ever learning and never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. So as knowledge is increasing exponentially, men would be ever learning but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. It's an amazing statement. From an article on Industry Tap written by David Schilling, he said, not only is human knowledge on average doubling every 13 months, he speculates we're quickly on our way with the help of the internet to the doubling of knowledge every 12 hours, as his opinion. That knowledge is on the way to doubling every 12 hours. To put it in context, in 1900, human knowledge doubled approximately every 100 years. By the end of 1945, the rate was every 25 years. Today, knowledge doubling every 13 months. And he foresees a future where it's doubling every 12 hours. And, you know, the stress on the human mind, just trying to keep up with things, you know, just trying to know what's going on. And so Daniel's prophecy, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase, is certainly an accurate description, it seems, of our age and describes characteristics of the end of the age to be aware of. So, number one, one sign of the end of the age or sign of the times that we're seeing happen is to look for an increase in this running to and fro. And I think the stress on the mind, the stress on human beings, and in a knowledge explosion. Look for that to continue to get worse, if it can be characterized that way, as far as what it's doing to human beings, this running to and fro and kind of a frazzled way of living, and Satan thus able to distract people or trying to distract people from living God's way of life. All of that kind of pressure does that. And we, you know, a wise man a number of years back, you may recall, advised all of us in God's church to simplify our lives. And have we taken that to heart in any way? It becomes more and more of a challenge to do that. Let's read verses 5 through 7 for another sign that Daniel said to look for, verses 5 through 7. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two others, one on this riverbank and one on that riverbank. And one said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, how long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be? Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. Interesting statement. A time period is mentioned. Time, times, and half a time. Now, you've been in the church for a number of years. You're familiar with what that's all about. But let's review a little bit. We'll come back to Daniel. But let's go to Revelation 12 to identify the length of that time. Revelation 12, verse 6, speaks about a time when the woman fled into the wilderness. We believe it's a reference to God's church, where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Period of time in the wilderness, 1,260 days. Elsewhere, the Bible speaks about a year for a day principle. It could refer to 1,260 years, which historically we know the church was under a period of persecution for 1,260 years. And won't go into that subject so much today. But then notice verse 14, speaking about the woman who was given two wings of a great eagle. Once again, in this case, to flee a certain type of persecution, that she might fly into the wilderness in her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. Verse 14 helps define time and times and half a time in combining it with verse 6 as 1,260 days or 1,260 years, a time being 1 year. Times being 2 years, and half a time, half a year, or a period of 3.5 years, 1,260 days. If you look at Revelation 11, verse 2, it speaks about the same period of time, the rising of the Gentile powers, and it speaks about treading the holy city underfoot for 42 months, 1,260 days, 3.5 years. So when Daniel speaks about a time where the power of the holy people is been shattered in a time of persecution, a time of trouble for God's people, and calls it time, times, and half a time. We believe that to be a period of 3.5 years. And it talks about a time when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, a time that corresponds to the Great Tribulation, which primarily it affects Israel and Judah. But it's a dangerous time for all true Christians, wherever they may be on the earth. Again, we'll come back, but let's read Matthew 24, verse 9. Matthew 24, verse 9. There is a critical period of 3.5 years. Matthew 24, verse 9 describes it this way. Matthew 24, 9. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Again, speaking about, you know, a time after the beginning of sorrows that Christ describes, a time when they would deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. Now, with that in mind, with those scriptures in mind, I'd like to share a couple of other articles. Now, these are not articles about God's people, about the church of God, but is in the context of what's happening to Christianity as it's perceived, the world's Christianity, so-called Christianity, let alone God's people. If this is happening to pseudo-Christians, when God's people are identified and targeted, what will it be like? I'll share a little bit of this with you. This is from Time Magazine, June 2016. Mary Eberstadt wrote an article entitled, "Regular Christians Are No Longer Welcome in American Culture." Now, that's just perception, you know, just out there by an observer of the news and a columnist. Regular Christians are no longer welcome in American culture. This is in Time Magazine. Traditional American Christians have long been on the losing end of culture war contests on school prayer, same-sex marriage, and other issues. But recent events, including the Supreme Court decision overruling Texas restriction on abortion clinics and the mandate that employers provide access to contraception, have added to the sense that religious expression is under attack. According to the recent Pew Research reports, the percentage of Americans who describe themselves as religiously affiliated has shrunk, while the percentage describing themselves as unaffiliated has grown. The percentage who say they are absolutely certain God exists fell from 63% to 71%, fell to 63% from 71% during the same period, 2007 to 2014. Fewer and fewer people say they are absolutely certain there is a God. This new vigorous secularism has catapulted mockery of Christianity and other forms of religious traditionalism into the mainstream and set a new low for what counts as civil criticism of people's most cherished beliefs. In some precincts, the faith of our fathers is controversial as never before. The basic founding Christian principles upon which our nation was built. Some of the faithful have paid unexpected prices for their beliefs. For example, the teacher in New Jersey suspended for giving a student a Bible. The football coach in Washington placed on leave for saying a prayer on the field at the end of a game. You may have read about some of these incidents in the news. The fire chief in Atlanta fired for self-publishing a book defending Christian moral teaching. The Marine court-martialed for pasting a Bible verse above her desk. And other examples of the new intolerance, anti-Christian activists hurl smears like bigot and hater at Americans who hold traditional beliefs about marriage and who accuse anti-abortion, and they accuse anti-abortion Christians of waging a supposed war on women. This has become the norm. Some Christian institutions face pressure to conform to secularist ideology or else. Flagship evangelical schools like Gordon College in Massachusetts and King's College in New York have had their accreditation questioned. Some secularists argue that Christian schools don't deserve accreditation, period. Activists have targeted homeschooling for being a Christian thing. Atheist Richard Dawkins, well-known, famous atheist, and others have even called homeschooling tantamount to child abuse. Homeschooling considered child abuse. Student groups like InterVarsity have been kicked off campuses. Christian charities, including adoption agencies, Catholic hospitals, and crisis pregnancy centers have become objects of attack. This is becoming more and more common in our nation today in the world of so-called Christianity, you know, within which we exist, not mainstream, not known, well known at this time, but the time will come when we will be well known and a target. This from Fox News, April 2018, an article titled, "How Long Will I Be Allowed to Remain a Christian?" An opinion piece by Douglas McKinnon. He says, "How long will I be allowed to remain a Christian?" That was the deeply dismaying question posed to me by a friend with four young children as we discussed the plight of the Christian faith in America and around the world. With each passing month, that shocking question becomes more relevant and even more disturbing. To say that Christians and Christianity are under a withering and brutal attack in certain places of the world would be an understatement. In various parts of the Middle East, there is a genocidal cleansing of Christians being carried out. Women, men, and their young children are being slaughtered because of their faith. And world leaders and most of the media turn their backs in bored indifference. Here in the U.S., Christians and Christianity are mocked, belittled, smeared, and attacked by some on a daily basis. This is a bigoted practice that is not only increasing exponentially, but is being encouraged and sanctioned by a number on the left. Too many of those who worship at the altar of political correctness have deemed that Christianity should no longer be respected. Rather, they assail it on a regular basis in a coordinated campaign to weaken the faith and its base. The prevailing view in much of the media is that Christianity is aligned with Republican, conservatives, or the views of President Trump, and therefore must be diminished and made suspect. The New Yorker just described the opening of a few Chick-fil-A restaurants. Why Chick-fil-A? The owners are highly religious and hold to traditional religious values and close down on the day they worship on Sunday. But they're perceived, again, for their religious conservatism. The New Yorker just described the opening of a few Chick-fil-A restaurants in New York City as pervasive Christian traditionalism and a creepy infiltration of New York City. So Christianity is an infiltration now. Instead of the founding principles upon which our nation was built, Christianity is described as an infiltration by some on the left. In college, they now teach about the evils of Christian privilege. The evils of Christian privilege. On Broadway and in theaters around the world, mocking Christians have become a massively profitable money-making venue. This is getting worse and worse and worse. In name, on the crucifix, and in art, Jesus Christ is desecrated in the most twisted and obscene of ways. In movies, on television, and online, Christians are portrayed in the most dishonest, prejudiced, and insulting of ways. Across the country, Christian colleges are under constant assault from social justice warriors seeking to strip their accreditation and put them out of business. Christian groups on campus are at times being persecuted, their offices and handouts vandalized, with members even being physically assaulted. How long can I remain a Christian is the title of the article. And, you know, you can go through you can search for this type of information and find a plethora of articles similar to this. And it's just getting worse and worse and worse. So this is what is happening, what is going on. And when Daniel says, you know, here in Daniel 12, verse 5, 6, and 7, the power of the holy people, there's a time when it will be completely shattered, the power of God's people. That time is not yet, and I'll comment on that as we go along. But look for another sign to be looking for. Look for a growing marginalization and hatred of Christians and Christian values, a growing marginalization and hatred of Christians and Christian values, and ultimately persecution of true Christians before the Great Tribulation. That is what Bible prophecy tells us is going to take place. A growing marginalization and hatred of Christians and Christian values, and ultimately persecution of true Christians before the Great Tribulation. Let's go back to Daniel. But Daniel chapter 7 in this case. Daniel 7. I want to read verses 1 through 7. To begin with Daniel 7, more from Daniel, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Daniel had a dream, and you're familiar with it, and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, "Arise, devour much flesh." After this I looked, and there was another beast like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, verse 17 explains this. Those great beasts, which are four kings. And your margin may point out, or kingdoms, or four kings representing kingdoms, which arise out of the earth. We understand these four kingdoms or empires to be the great empires through history. Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, and ultimately the Roman Empire. We believe that this is a reference to those great empires from what else we find in Scripture and through history. But notice verse 8. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn. The last beast that had 10 horns, another horn came up, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Now, we believe, and we'll read some more verses about this, that this horn, this little horn, represents a powerful religious system that would align with the last seven of the 10 political horns which arise after the fall of Rome. That it would align with the Roman Empire. That it would eventually form what became known as the Holy Roman Empire, a religious, powerful religious influence aligned with the political influence of the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire. Let's read more about this horn, verse 21 and 22. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came. And a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So this little horn makes war against God's people. Through history, that has happened, and it will happen at the end of the age as well. Verse 25, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, so against God, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. There's that time of trouble again where even the saints come under persecution, come under a great deal of stress. This little horn makes war against the saints, speaks pompous words against God, intends to change times and laws, enforce certain things, and support certain direction of the political, military empire that it is aligned with, and persecutes the saints for a time. Times and half a time, 3.5 years. Now, we know from history there is a great deal of evidence of this persecution can be seen through the centuries as hundreds and even thousands of God's people in Europe lost their lives through persecution, the Inquisition of the Roman Catholic Church, and other actions that the Roman Church took. Took the lives of many thousands of God's people. They were tortured. They were forced or told to confess, you know, as being heretics or to embrace the Catholic faith, those who would not submit to the authority of the church and the Pope, died, were killed, were martyred. And there is a great deal of evidence in the history of that. The Inquisition doesn't exist anymore. At least at this time it doesn't. That's been done away with. And you've probably read some of the horror stories of how that was conducted. That has been done away with. But the Bible indicates that there will be coming another persecution at the hands of this little horn. It will come back and result in the death of some Christians, of some true Christians. That the saints, as it says, the saints shall be given into his hand, verse 25, into the hand of the little horn. This prophecy has both a historical, has been fulfilled in history and will happen again at the end time. Verse 26 says, "But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion of this little horn to consume it and destroy it forever." Daniel also saw the conclusion concerning the little horn, that when Christ returns, the court, meaning judgment, shall be seated, and they'll take away his power and take away his dominion and consume and destroy it forever. Verse 27, the vision couldn't end with anything greater than this. "Then the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominion shall serve and obey him." The prophecy ends by revealing that Jesus Christ will establish the kingdom of God on earth, and he and the saints will rule in that kingdom. The power of the holy people has not yet been shattered at this time. Our work of preaching the gospel to the world is not yet finished. And Christ won't allow this work of preaching the gospel to be stopped until he decides it's the time. To me, these scriptures indicate that it's not up to us to decide, as some have decided, that the work is over. We no longer need to be a part of something preaching the gospel because Mr. Armstrong died, all of that's behind us. But to me, these scriptures indicate that only Christ will decide when that time has arrived. It's not up to human beings to decide when the power of the holy people has been shattered and the work of preaching the gospel is done. We can't just arbitrarily say we're done. That's up to Christ to point out, Christ to decide. So Daniel 12, verse 7 also says, "Until all these things shall be finished." Again, going back to Daniel 12, verse 7, we read this statement earlier, but there is that phrase there, "When the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things," referring to the time of trouble in verse 1. All those things, that time will come. All these things will be finished. That time of trouble, of great tribulation, it ends with the return of Christ. Notice that, let's go back to Matthew 24. We'll come back to Daniel, but let's notice what Matthew, Mark, and Luke say about this time of trouble that ultimately will shatter the power of the holy people. Matthew 24, verse 21 and 22 calls it a time that there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved alive. No human beings would be left alive. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Verse 29 and 30. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." Ending that time, tribulation. Mark 13. Mark described it slightly differently. Mark 13, verses 19 and 20. Mark 13, verse 19. "For in those days there will be tribulation, such as has not been seen since the beginning of the creation, which God created until this time, nor ever shall be. And unless the Lord has shortened those days, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, whom he chose, he shortened the days." That will happen. And then Luke 21. In verse 22, Luke 21, in verse 22. Notice Luke applies a little different word in describing this time. Luke 21, verse 22. He says, "For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled." The days of vengeance, a time like no other that is going to take place. Let's go to Revelation 12 and read verses 7 through 14. Revelation 12 and verses 7 through 14. Why does this have to be an end time setting? What do you see in these verses, verses 7 through 14 of Revelation 12, that tell you this is clearly an end time setting? Not the first time this happened, but clearly an end time setting. Revelation 12, verse 7. And war broke out in heaven. That happened anciently in history, before, you know, the creation of man. War broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Then, when this happens, I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, "Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down." Clearly an end time reference, because there were no brethren. The first time this happened, when Lucifer became Satan the devil and was cast out of heaven, there were no brethren at that time. This is an end time setting. Through history there have been brethren, God's people. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives to the death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea, for the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, because he knows that he has a short time. Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. But the woman was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. An end time setting. So there is this period of 3.5 years from the beginning of tribulation until all these things are finished. The time of persecution of Satan stirs up hatred, intense hatred against God's people, and seeks to persecute God's people. God will protect his people. Some may be martyred in that time. We don't know how that's going to work, but we know it is going to be a time when our faith will be tested. And we pray daily, don't we, for God to help us to grow in faith now when it's relatively easy, and to practice our faith diligently and, you know, in our worship of God on the Sabbath, in our own personal prayer and study and drawing close to God, so that we have faith then when it's really a difficult time of stress and a time of trouble like no other. We pray and ask God for faith. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 12 and now read verses 8 and 9, where something else we're told to be watching for and looking for. And I wonder if this is where we are right now. Daniel 12, verse 8. Although I heard these things that were just revealed to him, Daniel said, I did not understand. Then I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? Verse 9. And he said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Daniel apparently understood some of what was he was inspired to write, but he was curious to know the final outcome. What will be the end? And he was told it would be sealed up until the time of the end. Then what? When it was unsealed in the time of the end, what would happen? Verse 10, many shall be purified, usually a symbol of some kind of trial, made white and refined. But the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand. The wicked, those who don't understand or ignore or break God's law, the wise, those who are living at the end of the age, who humbly obey God's commands and God's way of life, are promised understanding. It says they will understand. The wise shall understand. And again, it makes me wonder, is this where we are right now? When I look around us and see what's going on in the world, and I see how God's people look and evaluate and understand what's going on around us, understand the conclusion of it, understand and see the danger, see the threats, and see the breakdown of the family and society and what's causing it and what's behind it and where it's taking people and why human lives are so running to and fro and confusion of the mind and, you know, just all that's happening to human beings. God's people understand why. Our religious leaders, in most cases, don't. Political leaders don't. educational leaders don't seem to understand. They look at it, from purely human terms. But God's people see clearly the evil that is growing in the society around us. You do. Our children do. You know, they understand the difference. Mom, why is this allowed at school? Why do they, we get into the whole subject of political correctness and the sexual confusion that's going on. Our children understand these things if they're of enough of an age to see the evil behind it and the danger signs. Very few, really, in the society around us of leaders see the danger in the direction we're going. But God's people do. And God, helps us to understand. And maybe verse 10 is where we are right now. We're certainly living in what seems to be the end of the age. But notice it says at the beginning of that verse, many shall be purified, made white, and refined. Is that some specific trial yet to come? Is it some ongoing trial? What is that referring to? Some trial that we in the church will experience yet? I think if we consider what's next in prophecy, I would look for trials to come that will purify us spiritually, that God will allow. And maybe we're in that right now as we try to resist the spirit of the age. That becomes harder and harder to resist the spirit of the age and how we live, just trying to live a Christian life. That's becoming harder. Maybe that's the trial that is going to refine and purify us as we more and more have to take a stand for what is right and against what is wrong. Maybe that's the trial that is referred to in verse 10. So, again, that's just my thought, speculation. Maybe this is where we are right now. But Daniel says more. Daniel 12, verse 11. Another thing he mentions. And from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the abomination of desolation is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. I think it's important to understand that the 1,260 days, the 1,290 days, the 1,335 days in the next verse all have the same end point. Their beginning points vary, but they all have the same end point, the return of Jesus Christ. They all end the same way with the return of Jesus Christ. But Daniel refers to daily sacrifices that will be restored. Now, there's a great deal to talk about a temple, a third temple. I gave a sermon in Beloit about that not long ago, about the third temple. But a temple is not needed for daily sacrifices. All that's needed is a place to sacrifice, an altar. Wouldn't have to have a temple. But there's some interesting things that have been going on. Did you know that back in April when we were observing Passover and the Jews observing it a day later, that in Jerusalem, Jewish activists were allowed to reenact the Passover sacrifice at the foot of the Temple Mount? And that was, I'll just read from the article. Activists who practice the annual sacrifice of Passover get closer to the site of the temple every year and long for the day when authorities will let them slaughter at the center of where they think the Temple Mount is. Israeli police in Jerusalem this past April greenlighted a religious ceremony which involves the slaughter of a Passover lamb. There were a lot of people who were not happy about that, especially an entire other faith, very unhappy about that. The slaughter of a Passover lamb only tens of meters from the site where the temple once stood. The Temple Mount activists carried out the sacrifice for more than 10 years now, but never before has a ceremony been taking place so close to Temple Mount. That happened this past April. So there is this pressure. We want to restore sacrifices. We want to sacrifice on this holy site, which incites the whole Muslim world pretty much. And an article from Newswatch, June 2016, about a high-profile temple activist who is now in the Netanyahu government. He's a member of government. A tumultuous week, this was written back in 2016, of Israeli politics has capped off a series of unlikely events that have brought Temple Mount activist Rabbi Yehuda Glick, I'm not sure what the German is, but it's something like that. There's probably an umlaut above it. Into the Israeli parliament as a member of Netanyahu's ruling coalition. Rabbi Yehuda is a veteran of the Israeli Temple Mount movement. He's a soft-spoken leader of the Temple Mount Heritage Foundation, has been described by friends and foes alike as the friendly face of Israel's Temple Mount movement. for years, this Temple Mount movement has been considered kind of a fringe element in Israel until this rabbi had an attempted assassination on his life. He was shot 4 times, and none of the bullets hit a vital organ. He survived, which the doctors said was miraculous. Within 1 month after 9 surgeries, he was able to leave the hospital giving thanks to God who raises the dead, is the way he described himself. He should have died, but he didn't. The assassination attempt and subsequent dramatic recovery catapulted him into the national spotlight, made him a household name, and breathed new impetus into the Temple Mount movement. And so he was elected to the Israeli government as part of the Netanyahu government. According to their website, the stated goal of the Temple Institute for now is to rekindle the flame of the Holy Temple in the hearts of mankind. Not a small goal, you know, not just among the Jews, but to rekindle this whole movement in the hearts of mankind, because they see this as important to the whole world. In the words of the Temple Institute, their long-term goal is to do all in our limited power to bring about the building of the Holy Temple in our time. As such, they are doing everything possible to be ready for the day when permission is granted. They are recreating and preparing vessels of the temple for actual use and are training priests in the complex ancient temple sacrifices and rituals. In addition, in a recently announced project, they are seeking to use advanced technology to secure the birth of a perfect red heifer, which is required for purification prior to the resumption of the temple services. This is from an item in Prophecy Newswatch, June 2016. So all of this is going on, you know, behind the scenes. And Daniel describes a time when sacrifices, daily sacrifices, will be established. And here's a group trying to rekindle the flame of the holy temple in the hearts of mankind in order to restore sacrifices. Daniel says that will happen, that in some way the daily sacrifices will be restored in Jerusalem. So as we look for what's happening now and signs of the end time, you know, look for animals, as unlikely as it seems, as impossible at this point that it seemed like it could happen. It got close with Passover sacrifice just this past April, there near the Temple Mount, close. Look for animal sacrifice to be restored. But then what? Verse 11 says, from the time that the daily sacrifice is taken away. The last time that happened was by an army. An army stopped that. Now, Revelation 17 describes the beast's power as a power that does what? Makes war with Christ. It's described as a warring power. Revelation 17, verse 12, 13, 14 describes the beast's power as making war with Jesus Christ. It's a warring power. It's not just a political, religious system. It's also a military system. All of that is included. Now, in understanding this taken away and the abomination of desolation, let's go back to Daniel 11. Daniel 11 describes a little bit more of this. Verse 40 through 45. At the time of the end, again, this same period of time, Daniel 11, verse 40, the king of the south shall attack him, the king of the north. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. He shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, the holy land. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain in Jerusalem. And he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So here we read the actions at the time of the end of a king of the north and a king of the south. And again, time of the end. The end time identities, specific identities of these nations are yet to be determined. As far as specifically identifying all the elements of the king of the north and all those in the king of the south, that's still to be identified. We can't say for certain. We do know that the establishment of the modern nation of Israel in 1948 is significant, that there is a nation of Israel from the time of the fall, you know, in 70 AD by the Romans until 1948, there was no nation called Israel. And so that is significant, that Jerusalem is now in this nation of Israel. With the Jewish nation now existing once again in the Middle East, then there is relevance to identifying the major powers to the north and the major powers to the south of Jerusalem, south of Israel. And this is a perspective basically from Jerusalem, north of Jerusalem and south of Jerusalem. And to the north, we have the European powers. To the south, we have the Arab world, the Arab powers. And the king of the north will likely, we believe, be a revival, a final revival of the Roman Empire that Daniel spoke of in Daniel chapter 7 and Revelation 17. We believe it will be a revival of that Roman Empire, and that it will initiate a counterattack against a king of the south. Exactly who the king of the south is, hard to say. Will it be an amalgamation? Will it be a confederation of Arab nations? That has taken place in the past. Will it be one Arab nation that rises up more prominent than all the others and initiates some sort of attack? It's hard to say. There is an interesting psalm. We'll come back to Daniel, but Psalm 83. In verses 1 through 5, Psalm 83, verses 1 through 5, an interesting prophecy. Psalm 83, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult. And those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones. They have said, 'Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, then that the name of Israel may be remembered no more.' For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you." And it's an interesting statement. To cut Israel off from being a nation, they form a confederacy. And perhaps that's what it's referring to. Maybe, you know, why? Why would they get all up in arms? Maybe a clash between these two powers over the treatment of Muslims in Europe are part of the effort to once again spread Islam over all the European nations. And European nations at this time seem to be reacting somewhat, wanting to, you know, some are, some aren't. They're a little concerned about what's happening within their borders. And maybe that will cause a reaction, or some threat to cut off oil supplies will cause a reaction, and a war breaks out. It's interesting that right now, among some of the Arab nations, there's still a moderate element. Still in Jordan, for example, or still maybe in Saudi Arabia to some degree, there's still somewhat of a moderate element, but there's also a growing fanatical element. ISIS, for example, and other terrorist groups. There's a statement in Obadiah, verses 6 through 8. You can find Obadiah. Right after the book of Amos is Obadiah, verses 6 through 8, a prophecy about that part of the world, Edom. We read in Obadiah, verse 6 through 8, "Oh, how Esau shall be searched out, how his hidden treasure shall be sought after, the descendants of Esau, the Arab world. All the men in your confederacy shall force you to the border. The men at peace with you shall deceive you and prevail against you. Those who eat your bread shall lay a trap for you. No one is aware of it. Will I not in that day, says the Lord, even destroy the wise men from Edom?" When there's a critical point, some crisis point, God is going, he said, destroy the wise men from Edom. Take away the wise, moderate elements. Destroy the wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountains of Esau. The moderate leader is gone, and in their place, perhaps fanatic firebrands who ultimately push at the king of the north in one way or another. Zechariah 14 describes this, and you're familiar with these verses. Zechariah 14, verses 1 and 2. Zechariah 14. Verse 1, "Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst, for I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Zechariah says an army or forces gathered at Jerusalem to fight there, to stop the sacrifices. So Daniel 11 again, going back to Daniel 12, verse 11, again talks about the abomination of desolation. If you turn a page back to Daniel 11, verse 31, here it describes forces mustered by him, and they shall by the king of the north. They shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Now, we believe that happened once in history, about 168 AD, a man named Antiochus Epiphanes. The commentaries say that he set up a statue of Jupiter Olympus in the Holy of Holies, offered swine's flesh on the altar, and desecrated the Jewish temple, and that was an abomination of desolation. We're not told exactly what it is going to be at the end of the age, just that it will happen. And Matthew 24 says, when you see the abomination of desolation, that the sign that the end is near. You know, flee Jerusalem. Because once again, it's going to be intense suffering. Luke 21:20 gives this warning. Luke 21:20. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Look for armies to be drawn to the Middle East in the end time. We can see the conditions are ripe for that even now, but look for when that happens. Finally, look for the beast power to rise more and more powerful in Europe, and for that alliance of church and state to take place. We believe between the beast power and the Roman Catholic Church. Look for that. Now, you know, right now it's, how can this happen? It doesn't, you know, there's a lot of turmoil, even in the European Union right now. Some nations strong, some nations weak. The immigration problem, some nations have chosen right-leaning leaders, some left-leaning leaders, and there's kind of a mix of things going on in Europe right now. Catholic Church right now has been, you know, discredited to a large degree in many ways by, you know, some of its transgressions in various nations around the world. But, you know, the Bible talks about Satan giving a religious leader certain power to do certain miracles and to create a following by these incredible miracles, and that could bring some things together very quickly. And this rise of a beast power in Europe and an alliance between church and state that could take place. Let's read a little bit about it as we kind of begin to wrap things up in Revelation 17. Revelation 17. Verses 1 through 5. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit in the wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy. Having seven heads and ten horns, the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abomination and the filthiness of her fornication. And on her forehead a name was written, Babylon, or Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." A beast that we believe is a continuation of the fourth great historical empire, the Roman Empire, a kingdom that was prophesied to receive a deadly wound and resurrect again. You know, that all of this seems to refer to that empire. And it seems that the woman sitting on the beast is controlling it, has power over it, just the way a rider on a horse with the reins controls it. And the woman is doing that. Adam Clark commentary says this about these verses. He's pretty straightforward. This is a representation of the Latin, and then in parentheses, Roman Church, in her highest state of anti-Christian prosperity. For she sits upon the scarlet-colored beast, a striking emblem of her complete domination over the secular Latin Roman Empire. This is, again, Adam Clark's commentary on the Bible. The Holy Roman Empire was thus the name of the empire centered in Europe and controlled by the Roman Catholic Church. This is Adam Clark's just straightforward opinion, though he doesn't make any bones about it. You know, and we believe that to be accurate. As for the seven heads, verses 9 and 10, here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings, nations, resurrections, recurrences. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. When he comes, he must continue a short time. Seven nations or kingdoms are successive government revivals, some of which have passed, the Roman Empire, one which exists at this time, but one yet to come. Successive governments concerning the ten horns, verse 12 and 13. The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they give their power and authority to the beast. Putting all of this together, it seems that the Scarlet Woman, the Roman Catholic Church, we believe, was prophesied to ride or control successive continuations of the Roman Empire, especially the last one that will arise at the end of the age. And where does that power actually come from? Revelation 13, verse 4. Revelation 13, verse 4. So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? The dragon gave authority to the beast. The last revival will be some combination of ten kings. Not sure exactly how that's going to be configured. Some combination of ten kings will come together to form a final, short-lived resurgence of the Roman Empire, powered behind the scenes by Satan the devil, and even having miraculous powers, the religious leader. So we look for this beast power to rise more and more powerful, and for this alliance of religion and state to form this tremendous alliance. These are things that Daniel pointed out and said would happen at the end of the age. I want to conclude with a quote and then one more scripture. I've been reading a book recently titled Churchill, Walking with Destiny. It's a long, long book. As a matter of fact, I had to take it back to the library before I could finish it, and I tried to renew it, but it was on hold, so I have to wait to finish the second half of the book when it's free. But it's quite interesting, and I've read a number of books on Churchill, and this one, Churchill, Walking with Destiny, a new publication. But in it, there is this quote that was made back in July, I think, 1918, to a friend of his when he was not quite 7 years old. And this is what Churchill told his friend when he was not quite 7 years old. He says, I can see vast changes coming over a now peaceful world, great upheavals, terrible struggles, wars such as one cannot imagine. Now, this is before World War I, it was even earlier than 1918. It was before World War I because he fought in World War I. And before World War II, he saw these upheavals, terrible struggles, wars such as one cannot imagine. And I tell you, London will be in danger. London will be attacked, and I shall be very prominent in the defense of London. I see further ahead than you do. I see into the future. This country will be subjected somehow to a tremendous invasion. By what means, I do not know. But I tell you, I shall be in command of the defense of London, and I shall save London and England from disaster. Dreams of the future are blurred, but the main objective is clear. I repeat, London will be in danger, and in the high position I shall occupy, it will fall to me to save the capital and save the empire. 7 years old, and Winston Churchill saw this in his mind. And I believe God used him in a very powerful way and gave him foresight so that he could save the world from the Nazi Empire. But he saw these things. Through understanding prophecy, God has given us a vision of the future, of what to expect, and especially of the end times, through understanding of prophecy that God has given to us through his Holy Spirit. And I think we can take great comfort in these words in Revelation 17. Revelation 17, and beginning in verse 14. Revelation 17, verse 14, I find very comforting in verses 14 through 17. These will make war with the Lamb, this beast power, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And the ten horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate, and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose, to be of one mind and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Notice verse 17. God has put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose. What happens, what is going to happen, is fulfilling God's purpose. Until the words of God are fulfilled. And as we watch events unfold, I think it's important to remember that all of these things happen to fulfill God's purpose until God's words are fulfilled. We can have confidence that God is in charge, that he is working out a great purpose, and he will bring it to his conclusion. We don't have all the answers about what's next in prophecy. We don't know all the details. Daniel gives us some signs, as does the book of Revelation. But we can pray, and I think very importantly, pray and ask God continually for the gift of spiritual discernment. Winston Churchill was given a vision, and he has certain discernment, but far more valuable is the gift of spiritual discernment, which you and I can ask God for continually. So that with that spiritual discernment, we can have the foresight and foreknowledge to be able to discern the difference between something that Satan's spirit is behind and something that God's spirit is behind. Pray and ask God for the gift of spiritual discernment, especially so that we won't be deceived as end time events continue to unfold. Prophecy will unfold exactly as God wants it to and according to his will. And we can have complete faith and confidence and rest assured that his word will be fulfilled.